The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. On this Friday, we remember author Harper Lee and also Justice Antonin Scalia, who lays in repose today within the sacred walls of the Supreme Court. Legal minds from across the country will join us to remember his best and his worst moments on the bench. Plus, we'll reveal the wild card winner in our America's Greatest Innovation Challenge. Listen to find out if your choice made the cut. But first, author Harper Lee has died at the age of 89. Lee won the Pulitzer Prize for her first novel, To Kill a Mockingbird, published in 1960. It became an instant bestseller and a cultural icon. To Kill a Mockingbird was, for more than 50 years, Lee's only novel, until about a year ago when HarperCollins announced it would publish another Lee manuscript, Go Set a Watchman. It's a novel that gave us a new understanding of protagonist Scout Finch and her father, Atticus. With us now to remember Harper Lee is her longtime friend, Starling Lawrence, editor-at-large at W.W. Norton. Starling Lawrence, welcome.
Good afternoon.
And I understand you've only just a little while ago heard the news of Harper Lee's death.
That is correct. I turned on my iPhone, and there it is as a sort of a pop-up New York Times announcement, and I was very surprised. I knew she wasn't in good health, but I did not know that she was in particularly bad health.
What are your reflections now on the life of your friend?
Harper Lee, it's an odd thing to try to sort of think about, but I think Harper Lee was such a vibrant, active, outgoing force of nature. This is a very ironic pairing with Justice Scalia, because Harper Lee to say the least, on the opposite side of the political spectrum from Justice Scalia. They'll have a lot to talk about with each other, wherever they are. She was a very outspoken liberal person, and you can sort of see where that is if you know To Kill a Mockingbird, where that comes from. And she was very, very well informed in the matters of politics and society. A very sharp mind, you know, well into her 80s. And so much fun. I just have to say, so much fun to be with. Great sense of humor.
We spent a lot of time this past summer with Go Set a Watchman when HarperCollins put it out. We read it on the show. We had a book club. But take us back to the early 60s for a moment, to the release of To Kill a Mockingbird and how it was received back then, before all of the acclaim.
Well, I'm old, but not that old. I was in college in the early 1960s, and I certainly knew about the book, but I didn't read it then. I mean, but just looking at any account of the publication and its subsequent, rise to fame and enormous commercial success, this book just touched a nerve. I tell you, I was at a writer's conference once about 15 years ago, and I mentioned to the driver of the bus taking people home that I knew Harper Lee. And this woman, this perfectly nice bus-driving woman, almost drove off the road. She was so excited because she taught school every year. Her seventh or eighth graders, whatever they were, she made them all write to Harper Lee after reading the book. And she said every one of those children got a handwritten letter back from Harper Lee, which might explain some of her ongoing sort of fame and the love that people had for her. She had an extraordinary communication with anybody, almost anybody who read that book.
And much more recently, Starling Lawrence, of course, there was some controversy, maybe speculation, around the publication of Go Set a Watchman, whether or not Harper Lee actually consented to it being published, whether she wanted it published, or whether it was family members who preferred that it would be published. Can you shed any light on that?
Harper Lee, Nell, as I knew her, was her first name, was a very, very strong-minded woman. And I think unless anybody has real first-hand conclusive evidence to the contrary, I think you have to give this book, its publication, and its connection to Harper Lee the benefit of the doubt. I mean, I heard everywhere when the book was first discovered and made public, or the subject of its publication made public, I heard a lot of pretty wild speculation among people I know pretty well. I just thought, gosh, we don't know that. And if Nell wanted to change her mind at the end of her life, if she thought that this book, as it was suggested to her, would be, you know, shed interesting light on the characters and the arc of To Kill a Mockingbird, what's her right to do that? And in fact, I think a lot of people feel that it isn't a completely different character. Atticus Finch is not a different character. It's another aspect, an older Atticus Finch. But I can easily see how Watchmen proceeded from the same pen that wrote To Kill a Mockingbird.
So, Starling Lawrence, what do you think now is the best way for someone to remember Harper Lee? I'm going to suggest that if it's been too long since you've read To Kill a Mockingbird or you haven't picked up Watchmen yet, to just go ahead and do it.
Oh, well, brilliant suggestion. I think in any case, the best way to remember an author is to reread or reread that author's books.
Starling Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us.
My great pleasure.
Starling Lawrence is editor-at-large at W.W. Norton, a longtime friend of Harper Lee, the author of To Kill a Mockingbird, Harper Lee, dead at 89. Law enforcement made a major move this week in its ongoing battle with tech companies that make the products we carry with us every day. This round, the FBI versus Apple and the iPhone. A federal judge has ordered Apple to help the FBI hack into an iPhone belonging to one of the San Bernardino shooters. So far, Apple is refusing on the grounds that creating a key to that encrypted phone would inevitably lead to privacy violations down the road. Plenty of lawmakers are siding with the FBI here. Here's Senator Dianne Feinstein from California, the home of the tech industry, but she's also the senior Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee.
This was a terrorist attack in my state. 14 people were killed in this attack. And if there is more evidence on a cell phone of other attacks possibly pending, of conspiracy that led to this attack, the Justice Department should know it.
Apple CEO Tim Cook says the government wants his company to create new iPhone operating systems to bypass security features, a system he says could fall into the wrong hands. It's the latest move in a long and critical game being played by the Justice Department in Silicon Valley. Here to tell us what's at stake is Susan Hennessy. She's a former attorney for the NSA, now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You know, on the one hand, this is about one iPhone and one case, the case of the San Bernardino shooters, as I just mentioned. But really, it seems this case is about a whole lot more, an ongoing controversy and a showdown between tech companies like Apple, but others, and law enforcement. Is that right? Can you describe sort of how big this case is?
Well, so look, I think it is a case about a single iPhone, and it's important to understand that on a technical level, this is a case about a single iPhone. So sort of the technological assistance that the FBI is requesting Apple give and that Apple create in this case would only works for a single phone. It's not something that can sort of be repurposed as a security threat to all sorts of other phones. So to that extent, it really is about one phone, one target, you know, subject to a warrant where a court has determined probable cause. That said, there's also enormous precedential value here. Whatever the court determines in this case as to whether or not this is an appropriate application of the relevant statute, the All Writs Act, and whether or not the creation of this software constitutes an undue burden under that act, that will have significant value moving forward.
But Susan Hennessy, as I know you're aware, a lot of the writing and concern about this case is around the fact that Apple is really being conscripted into helping the government undermine the security of global computing. I mean, Apple doesn't really have any type of relationship with these suspects in the San Bernardino shooting other than they bought a phone that Apple made, and all of a sudden the government says, you have to make software that can break into that phone. They're, in a sense, conscripting them into helping the government do a search, and that's troubling to a lot of people.
So I can certainly understand why sort of when Apple frames it that way, it seems sort of troubling and like this is really a new thing. This is not really a novel concept under the law. There are a number of different laws by which telecommunications providers, software manufacturers, device manufacturers are required to provide assistance, technical assistance to the government. So in this case, the assistance being asked is not a request to undermine global security. It is to develop software to disable a number of security features unrelated to encryption on a specific phone. Again, whatever they create in this case. And in terms of sort of the conscription element, this is a foundational principle in American law that companies that are not so far removed, and Apple is not so far removed because it provides the device in question, it licenses the software, and it developed the security mechanisms that the FBI now needs assistance in circumventing. So this is really not a novel application of the law. It's a rather traditional sort of request. It's moving into a new technological arena.
As long as law enforcement needs a key into these iPhones, I mean, I know the NSA isn't a law enforcement agency. Can't the FBI just get the software from the NSA to crack an iPhone, Susan Hennessy?
So the relationship between the intelligence communities and domestic law enforcement is relatively complex under the law. The FBI actually is part of the FBI, is part of the intelligence community. Look, sort of bottom line, in theory, potentially, I can't even sort of imagine the set of facts that would that would sort of present itself such that that would be legal.
I guess the question is, can the NSA crack that iPhone if they want to?
I mean, I'm completely unable to speak to sort of any kind of NSA operational capabilities. What I will say is that it should make both civil libertarians and law enforcement and the intelligence community very, very nervous to think that the tools of the U.S. intelligence community, whatever they might be, should be applied to domestic law enforcement. There are different sets of laws. There are different sets of protections. There are different constitutional appropriations and congressional appropriations. And I don't think that it's sort of, it would be either appropriate, prudential, or even potentially legal to sort of mix those two capabilities, except for in very, very limited and controlled circumstances.
Susan Hennessy, former attorney for the NSA, now at the Brookings Institution. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Flags are at half-mast all over Washington, D.C. this week. This morning, Justice Antonin Scalia's body was carried up the steps of the Supreme Court past the 8 sitting justices, and now Scalia lays in repose in the court's great hall, surrounded by marble busts of former chief justices. It's a solemn tradition that dates back to 1873. There's a funeral for Justice Scalia scheduled for Saturday in Washington. Antonin Scalia loved to be heard. In oral arguments and written opinions, he joked, he criticized, he judged. In our own remembrance today, The Takeaway asked legal experts and Scalia's colleagues to reflect on some of his best and his worst moments in 30 years on the high court. Here's Mark Graber, University of Maryland law professor and one of the leading scholars on constitutional law and politics in the country. He was struck by Scalia's written opinions on the war on terror and on gay marriage.
Best opinion is probably Hamdi versus Rumsfeld, the case dealing with the detention of an American citizen, where both Scalia and Justice Stevens pointed out that the government had two choices, treason or suspend habeas corpus. It was a nice opinion. It made very clear what the constitutional rules were. I think it was creative. It was something very few people saw, but when you read it, it was rather convincing. Worst opinion, for a liberal, there are many, but I'll go with Obergefell. In the last years on the bench, Scalia increasingly turned to insult rather than argument. Obergefell has a great many insults, but it really does not engage with Justice Kennedy's arguments. There are weaknesses in the argument, but Scalia preferred to write for the 5 o'clock news rather than engage in a way that lawyers might appreciate.
Justice Scalia, in a blistering dissent, was not buying
Justice
it.
Justice Antonin Scalia, furious in his dissent, on the losing side again.
And again, he really hammers his dissent.
It's hard to pick a single best opinion, but I'm going to go with Justice Scalia's dissent in Morrison against Olson.
Lee Lieberman Otis clerked for Antonin Scalia after his appointment to the Supreme Court and is now the senior vice president of the Conservative Federalist Society. She chose a case from 1988, one that led to the appointment of Kenneth Starr to investigate President Bill Clinton a decade later.
At the time, it looked like a big loss for the separation of powers, but over time, I think it came to be accepted as correct by people across the political spectrum and played a significant role in Congress's decision not to reauthorize the independent counsel statute. The opening of that opinion, which begins, "This case is about power," and then goes on to say that cases like this often come as very small initial intrusions, coming, as it were, as a wolf in sheep's clothing. But then he goes on to say, in one of the best lines in his usual opinion, I think, "But this wolf comes as a wolf."
Among the best, Scalia's dissenting opinion in the 2000 case Dickerson versus the United States, which declined to allow Congress to overrule the court's famous Miranda decision.
Marianne Franks is a professor of law at the University of Miami. Scalia was at his best, she says, when ruling on defendants' rights, and at his worst, on protection from domestic violence.
However one feels about the importance or necessity of Miranda rights, the argument that they are required by the Constitution is shaky at best. Scalia ruthlessly pointed out how no less an authority than Chief Justice Rehnquist, the author of the majority opinion, had himself previously stated that Miranda rights were not constitutionally required. Among the worst, Scalia's majority opinion in the 2005 case Castle Rock v. Gonzalez, which shows the deeply unprincipled side of his much-celebrated textualism. Jessica Gonzalez argued that her local police department violated her constitutional rights by failing to enforce the plain terms of the protective order she had against her estranged husband. The police ignored her repeated pleas for help after her husband abducted the couple's 3 children, who were later found dead in his truck. Scalia maintained that the word "shall arrest" in the protective order did not in fact mean "shall arrest." The police were not obligated to act. This opinion was devastating for domestic violence victims, as it meant that protection orders, one of the only forms of legal protection victims have against abusers, were quite literally not worth the paper they were printed on.
Much of the court's opinion is devoted to deprecating the closed-mindedness of our forebears with regard to women's education, and indeed with regard to the treatment of women in areas that have nothing to do with education. Closed-minded they were.
The court ruled in 1996 on the No Women policy at the Citadel Military Academy in Virginia, and in 1990 on religious freedom. Here's Michael McConnell, former circuit judge at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit.
So to counterbalance the court's criticism of our ancestors, let me say a word in their praise. They left us free to change. The same cannot be said of this most illiberal court, which has embarked on a course of inscribing one after another of the current preferences of the society, and in some cases only the counter-majoritarian preferences of the society's law-trained elite, into our basic law. So if that's my favorite, my least favorite Scalia opinion is Employment Division versus Smith, the peyote case. It pays very little attention to the text of the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment, and absolutely no attention to its history, and plays fast and loose with the precedent. But that only goes to show that Justice Scalia had clear understandings of how to interpret the Constitution that we can hold up and say on some occasions we disagree with how he applied them. That's certainly better than justices who have no clear approach to begin with, other than to tell us the result that they want to see. Justices who just have a result they want to see are never wrong by their own opinions. So to be able to say that Justice Scalia got one wrong by his own lights is actually quite a compliment.
Antonin Scalia was always ready to be judged on the quality of his legal opinion, so we thank the legal minds who offered their thoughts on his legal legacy. Later this hour, we'll remember a different version of Justice Scalia with a man who studied him up close and personal. Actor Edward Giro played Antonin Scalia in The Originalist, a play that was staged in Washington, D.C. last year.
Yes, it was a dream because it combined my love of our experiment of democracy and my job as an actor to bring someone of that stature to life.
Actor Ed Giro remembers Justice Antonin Scalia. That's later this hour on The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, offering tech services for small business owners like PC setup and repair. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples, make more happen. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
Whoa.
Mm.
Oh, my God!
Oh, stewardess, I speak jive.
As promised, it is movie day here on The Takeaway, and as promised, Rafer Guzman is here with me to weigh in. He's film critic for Newsday. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
It's great to have you. We're going to talk today about the new horror film, The Witch, set in 1630s, a film about witchcraft and black magic possession. Now, I have trivia in the spirit of The Witch. So, Rafer, I want you to listen to this audio trivia. If you're listening at home, you can tweet me if you know the answer, at Todd Zwillick. Rafer, you're not going to answer now. Hold on to your answer.
Okay.
We'll come back to it for people who know at the end of the segment. All right, we're talking about The Witch today. As I said, possession in the 1630s. Step into my world for just a moment, into the world of politics, and listen to this infamous political ad. See if you know who this candidate is.
I'm not a witch. I'm nothing you've heard. I'm you.
I'm not a witch. Who is that? That's your trivia question. Hold on to that till the end of the segment. Now, while we're talking about witches, the new film, The Witch, director David Eggers, set in 1630. Let's listen to a clip, Rafer.
I am thine enemy, wallowing in the blood and filth of my sins.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to rest in the grass.
Terrifying. Sorry, Robert Eggers. I said David Eggers is the author, of course,
yes.
Got into my mind. And I got possessed by the wrong Eggers. This sounds horrifying.
Yeah, this is an interesting film. Big hit at Sundance. Robert Eggers, the director, won the directing award at Sundance last year. And it's really, you know, kind of an art film. It's a low-budget film shot out in the wilds of Ontario. Like you said, it takes place in the 1630s. There's a family that's been banished from their colony, I think because the father – it's a little difficult to tell, but I think because the father has these very zealous religious beliefs. I think it takes a lot to get banned from a colony back then for your
sure
religious
does.
Beliefs. He takes his family out into the woods. They start their own little farm, and things begin going wrong. The crops fail. The livestock begins acting up. And one of the daughters, Thomason, played by Anna Taylor-Joy, begins to realize that her family is looking at her and suspecting her of being a witch, that she has brought all this misfortune on the family. Great premise, really interesting. It's all, as you heard, done with authentic period dialogue, really richly detailed. But this is not your usual kind of bump in the night, scary faces, flickering lights, horror film. This is really kind of it's a drama, this very richly produced, richly visualized drama. And yet A24, the studio, is going to put it out in wide release and see how it does. I thought it was amazing. I mean, you are really taken back into this time, and there is something truly horrifying about the idea of being trapped out in the middle of nowhere with your family, who is now looking at you as if you are the source of all their problems. And we all know what happened to witches back then. It's a really, really mesmerizing and very gripping film. I loved it. It'll be really interesting to see how it plays with a modern horror audience. I don't know.
That isolation, because, you know, with a lot of horror films, as much as I enjoy them, they're never really scary. They kind of go, but you're not truly frightened.
That's because I feel like there's a sort of horror films have gotten into the business of being scary films. So they try to, you know, they do the boo. Someone jumps out, you know. You've got the Paranormal Activity films where, you know, it's a lot of doors slamming, lights flickering. There's always someone jumping out at you. But they're not horrifying. There's something horrifying about the idea that your mom and dad may actually want to kill you. That's more than scary.
Sure is. Okay, so while we're on the topic of witches, let's go back to trivia. I asked you to step into the political world. We're talking about witches, Rafer Guzman. Listen to this clip and see if you know this candidate.
I'm not a witch. I'm nothing you've heard. I'm you.
Rafer?
I am just absolutely stumped, Todd. I do not know.
JP Dempsey on Twitter knows it. That's Christine O'Donnell from 2010, Tea Party candidate, one of the first Tea Party candidates from Delaware.
Oh, there you go.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thanks.
Thanks, Todd.
You're not a witch, are you?
I am not a witch.
But you're dressed as one. All right. The late Justice Antonin Scalia knew he was divisive, and he loved it. For half the country, Scalia is remembered as a hardcore conservative, anti-gay gun rights fanatic, and for the other half, a hero, a brave champion of the Constitution.
To interpret the Constitution as it is written, and as it was understood when the authors crafted the original document. It's as simple as that. Now, the other side of the argument is obvious and wrong. The Constitution is a living document. It must change with the times. Nonsense. Society changes. Fashion changes. The Constitution stands.
That's actor Ed Gero performing as Justice Antonin Scalia in The Originalist, a play by John Strand performed last spring at the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor went to see the play during its run, as did we here on The Takeaway. Scalia himself never attended a performance, but he was well aware that his bombastic personality would live on through Edward Gero. Gero spent a year studying Scalia, attending oral arguments, and meeting with him in his chambers and over lunch. Edward Gero, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Todd. Although there are sad circumstances, I'm happy to be with you today.
Sad circumstances because you struck up a friendship with Antonin Scalia when you were learning how to play him. Describe how you've been feeling over the last week, though, Ed.
Well, it's been an emotional roller coaster. I was very grateful to have had the time and to be brought into his circle. He was so open and generous about that, and to invite me into his chambers and into his life. I feel as if I've lost a family member, and sad because I mostly regret the stories that will not be told and the memories that won't be made, but I'm very grateful for the memories that I have and will treasure for the rest of my life.
Describe some of those memories, if you would. Maybe you'll take us inside the chambers a bit, or inside lunch with Antonin Scalia. Describe your relationship with him.
It was daunting at first. I knew I had a job to do as an actor, to observe him, to gain as much information as I could about his character and his behavior. When we first met in his chambers after watching him at the court, we had stared at each other. We locked eyes when he was on the bench. He knew I was in his seat as his guest. We had never met before. And there was a long, seemed forever, it was probably a minute, where we locked eyes, and he nodded after that and held forth. I just wanted to make sure I didn't melt underneath the gaze of this giant. But that sort of trepidation, he pulled the rug out from under that immediately. When I walked into chambers, finally, he got up and we sort of sidled up and didn't quite know how to greet each other. But he finally said, "Well, I just want you to know I'm not coming to see the play, but I'm glad they got a good actor to do it, so I won't be embarrassed. Let's have some lunch." And we very rapidly found common ground in our heritage, our roots in New Jersey, the Roman Catholic Church, our Italian-American heritage. But what I tried to bring to the table was to find a way to connect with him in terms of how he thought, not necessarily what he thought, but how he processed. And we talked about my approach to Shakespeare and an approach to interpretation, and if that was analogous to his approach to the Constitution. And he gave me the green light on that, that I understood his, as a professor and as a, someone who works doing text analysis all the time for such complex language like Shakespeare, it made sense as an analogy to the Constitution.
Edward Giroux, it seems as though it's an actor's dream, isn't it, to play Washington's most colorful, controversial, most charismatic person to get the chance to inhabit Antonin Scalia. Seems like almost a dream come true for an actor like you.
Well, it's true. It is. Because you get to become an artist citizen. It's wonderful being in Washington in the seat of government. I've always been a patron in the sense that I enjoy the process of government, but to be that close to the process in a particularly interesting year on the court, yes, it was a dream because it combined my love of our experiment of democracy and our my job as an actor to bring someone of that stature to life.
I want to talk about the aftermath of Justice Scalia's death. There's been some controversy, I suppose, at frankly some of the joy that some of his political enemies have taken in his death. And surely that's tasteless, but enemies. You know, Scalia himself said that a man who has made no enemies hasn't done anything interesting. He relished having enemies, right? He reveled in it. He was an excellent, joyous troll. And I wonder if, since you knew him to some degree, whether you think that this reaction to his death is something that he would have expected or even enjoyed.
I think the rising of the opposition was, in a sense, a validation of his sense of clarity about what he saw. And of course there were going to be people of other opinions. That's part of the job. That's part of what one would expect as a justice on the Supreme Court. His job was to be clear and precise and to create an argument as best he could, given what he called the rule of law was a law of rules. There was a way to approach it. And of course people would have another opinion. But you didn't have to demonize the other person. You don't have to be an opponent. There is an opposite, but not become an opponent. Look at the relationship between he and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, for example. You couldn't get a clearer opposites there, but they were good friends. And that's precisely what John Strand was going for in terms of the larger conversation that happens in The Originalist. He was prescient in a way. One of the last lines of the play, when the young law clerk asks Justice Scalia, "You drive your own car, that's dangerous. You know, people get killed in cars every day." And he responds in the play, "Half the country would cheer, and the other half will be arguing over who replaces me on the bench." And that's precisely what's happened.
Edward Giroux, you're somebody who lived in Antonin Scalia's words as part of your work, and we'll forget about the law for a minute.
Absolutely.
There are no more Antonin Scalia words. He's done writing, he's done speaking. What are we going to miss? What have we lost with no more of those words?
We'll lose his insights. We'll lose his humor. We'll lose his alacrity of language, just the beauty of the way he can construct, and his clarity. I hope that The Originalist is part of his legacy, that all the work that I did and all the experience that I had of being with him, I had the opportunity to bring that to life to people who don't understand the inside of the court. And I think he was prescient on that. The last note I received from him was really lovely. I thanked him for the year, and he wrote me back and talked about the year, and it was a difficult term for him, more dissents than ever. He said that, "I've enjoyed the friendship that The Originalist serendipitously created, and I hope that the end of one will not be the end of the other." Now, in that context, when I got it, I thought, terrific, he wants to continue the friendship. But now, it feels that he understood the opposite of that, that the end of one, our friendship, would not be the end of the other. He called me the doppelganger, and in some way, he might have been prescient about the fact that he knew I was going to be, in some way, his doppelganger, the spokesperson. I was going to be the embodiment of who he was after he was gone.
Edward Giroux portrayed Justice Antonin Scalia in The Originalist on the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. last spring. Edward Giroux, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
And here's something to take with you today. A Chicago judge has agreed to hear a lawsuit on whether Senator Ted Cruz is eligible to be president. The suit alleges that Cruz is not a natural-born citizen and is therefore ineligible to be on the ballot. Now, Cruz himself jokes about this.
I was born as a small child that lived up in Canada. You may have heard that.
That was Ted Cruz when I saw him at church on the Sunday before the New Hampshire primary. The suit was filed by Illinois attorney and Ben Carson supporter Lawrence Joyce. It was not filed by Donald Trump, though the GOP frontrunner has threatened to sue Cruz for that very same reason. Trump, of course, hopes that South Carolina voters are going to be thinking about that before tomorrow's Republican primary. Thanks so much for listening. If you're in South Carolina, go out and vote. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, offering tech services for small business owners like PC setup and repair. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples, make more happen.
PRI, Public Radio International.